Good morning. Thursday, April 9th. I'm Indu.
And I'm Ava. Welcome to Morning Signal.
How are you doing this morning?
Honestly, I've been awake since 5 thinking about the NATO stuff. We'll get there. How about you?
I've been staring at oil charts and trying to decide if any of this makes sense. Spoiler, it doesn't. But we'll break it down.
Okay, so where do you want to start?
Let's start with markets and macro, because there's a lot going on and some of it is actually kind of hopeful, weirdly.
Set the table.
So over on Excess Returns this week, they had Jim Paulson on, and he came in with this framing that I've been chewing on. The Walmart to luxury retailer ratio, which is basically a stress gauge for how much consumers are rotating toward value, has hit levels matching 2008, which sounds terrifying. But Paulson's whole argument is that the context is completely different.
Because in 2008, everyone was leveraged to the eyeballs.
Exactly. Household and corporate balance sheets, right now, are near decades-long lows in debt burden. The opposite of pre-GFC. So Paulson's thesis is what he's calling a bull within a bull. The mega-cap, new-era trade is fading, but broad market plays, small caps, value, cyclicals, equal-weight S&P, international, are starting to take the baton.
Does he actually believe that, or is he talking his book?
I mean, he's always been a structurally optimistic guy, so take it with some salt. But the data point that stuck with me was this. Total U.S. corporate profits are still about 10% below trend, while S&P 500 earnings are 20% above it. That gap has never been this wide in the post-war era, which implies there's a lot of profit recovery runway in the non-tech economy if the cycle holds.
Right. The Mag 7 has been carrying the whole earnings story.
And Paulson thinks that's shifting. He also flagged that the jobs numbers look better than they are. The April headline print was 177,000, but if you average in the prior 2 months with revisions, you're down closer to 40,000, which is basically flat payroll growth for 6 months.
That's a very different story than the headline.
Very different. And his call is that a Fed easing cycle triggered by weakening jobs, combined with record cash on the sidelines and extreme pessimism indicators, actually sets up near-term upside in the broad market. Not a crash, a rotation.
I'll stay skeptical, but I'll hold the number. Okay, there was something on Odd Lots this week that I want to get to because I found it genuinely fascinating.
The Paterfy One?
The Paterfy One. So Thomas Paterfy, founder of Interactive Brokers, for anyone who doesn't know him, was on Odd Lots talking about prediction markets and IBKR's push to basically institutionalize the whole space. They got their CFTC license in 2024. They're launching a consolidated prediction market feed at the end of May that would aggregate contracts across CalSure, Polymarket, and others and route orders for best execution.
Like how they handle equities across 20 exchanges.
Exactly that model. And the vision is interesting. ForecastX, their platform, deliberately excludes sports betting and pop culture stuff. Only economically consequential questions.
Recession probability. IE adoption, global warming metrics.
The explicit pitch is, this is for serious institutional investors.
What's the regulatory hang-up?
The SEC-CFTC jurisdictional split. You can't list company-specific contracts, like, will NVIDIA beat earnings, because anything that affects a stock price might be a security, under SEC jurisdiction. And Paterfy wants that resolved, because those are obviously the most commercially valuable contracts.
They're also the most obviously useful for price discovery.
Right.
And he had this wild take buried in the interview. He said he's in favor of abolishing insider trading laws entirely, across all markets. His argument is that if trading on information is legal, it disseminates to the market in seconds instead of weeks.
That will never happen.
It will absolutely never happen. But the prediction market framing makes it slightly more coherent because in those markets, the argument for information efficiency is stronger. And the quote that stuck with me was about economists. He said prediction markets will eventually make economists obsolete as forecasters because the good ones will just trade their views instead of publishing reports.
Honestly, not the worst outcome for anyone who's ever read an economist's market forecast.
Hard agree. And then the Waymo episode of Odd Lots search engine series. You have to hear this if you haven't.
The Robotaxi one? I listen to most of it.
So they laid out Waymo's safety data across 127 million miles. Roughly 80% fewer airbag deploying crashes than human drivers. 90% fewer serious injury crashes. 200 million miles driven with zero fatal crashes caused by Waymo.
That's actually a stunning number.
It is. And the context that makes it more striking, in 2018, Waymo safety drivers had to intervene once every 5,600 miles. Uber's safety drivers were intervening once every 13 miles. That is a 400-to-1 gap in performance.
And Uber cut their safety crew to one person anyway.
And then Elaine Herzberg died. The episode spends real time on that, and on Anthony Lewandowski downloading 14,000 proprietary files before jumping to Uber, eventually pleading guilty to trade secret theft, settling for $245 million, and is now apparently back in business with Uber funding.
That is a remarkable second act.
The broader market point is that this is no longer R&D. Waymo's in 10 cities. Aurora just put driverless trucks on Texas highways. Kodiak AI is operating in the Permian Basin. The 4.8 million Americans who drive for a living are now in the crosshairs simultaneously from multiple angles.
And the one thing pushing back is labor organizing in blue cities. The episode made the point that unlike lamplighters or knocker-uppers, 4.8 million organized drivers backed by unions and Democratic politicians actually have political leverage over deployment timelines.
Which is a real constraint on the business. Geographic fragmentation is probably the near-term reality.
Okay, I want to come back to politics for a second because the All-In Pod this week had Josh Shapiro on, and I think it's worth spending a minute on the economic substance, even if you're not a Pennsylvania politics person.
Go for it.
So Shapiro came on to make the case for what he's calling moderate Democratic governance. Pennsylvania's the only growing economy in the Northeast. He's done 7 tax cuts. Permitting turnaround went from bottom 5 to top 5 nationally. Violent crime down 12%. Unemployment below the national average for 32 consecutive months. He's running the receipts.
That's a real record.
It is. But the part that's most relevant for the macro picture is his tariff breakdown. He ran through what Trump's tariffs are actually costing Pennsylvania households right now in concrete terms. Coffee up 30%, beef up 19%, OJ up 9%, fertilizer up 36%. Gas in Pennsylvania is at $4.15 for 16 per gallon.
And fertilizer pricing ripples out into food prices for months.
Months. And then you layer on top of that his projection that the beautiful budget bill strips healthcare from roughly 500,000 Pennsylvanians and closes 26 rural hospitals. That combination, tariff inflation plus healthcare collapse in rural swing state America, is a really specific political and economic pressure point heading into the midterms.
What did he say about Iran?
That's where it got interesting. His line was, "If you don't know why you're going in, you don't know how the hell to get out." He pointed out that Trump never defined mission objectives, which makes exit criteria impossible. And the alleged justification, stopping Iran's nuclear capability, directly contradicts what Rubio said 7 or 8 months ago about already having destroyed it.
Wait, Rubio said that?
That was Shapiro's claim, yeah. 13 U.S. service members killed, and gas above $4, and nobody can articulate what winning looks like.
There's also a really sharp Israel critique in there. For a Jewish American politician, it's notable.
Very notable. He said Netanyahu made Israel more isolated, fractured by partisan U.S. support, and was not minding the shop when October 7th happened. And then this line about America never being led around by any other nation that was pretty clearly pointed in one direction without saying it explicitly.
Okay, let's shift to tech and AI because there's a lot there this week.
Your territory.
So the A16Z podcast had this debate that I've been thinking about. Vitalik Buterin and Guillaume Verdon, the effective accelerationism guy behind Extropic, going back and forth on AI governance.
That's a conversation I would have watched for 3 hours.
It's really good. The surprising thing is how much they agree on. Both are pro-open source. Both are explicitly anti-power concentration. Both think the 6-month pause framing was always insufficient. The disagreement is sharper and more specific than I expected.
What's the core split?
Hardware access. Verdon's position is that AGI acceleration is basically thermodynamically inevitable. Deceleration doesn't buy safety, it buys fragility, and decelerating mindsets lose by Darwinian selection. Buterin agrees with a lot of that, but adds one specific concern, a unipolar risk where AI enables permanent, inescapable surveillance-backed dictatorship. He cites Russia as a near-term preview.
And his proposed remedy is
a hardware inspection regime analogous to nuclear non-proliferation. Like, you want to count GPUs the way you count warheads.
How does Verdon respond to that?
He calls it geopolitically unenforceable and argues alternative compute, superconducting hardware, neuromorphic chips, potentially 10,000 times more energy efficient, will render GPU controls moot within the relevant time frame. And the more interesting economic argument is that diffused AI hardware may actually be a national security interest in itself.
That's actually where these things connect. If energy-efficient compute gets cheap enough, the control bottleneck disappears.
Right.
And Buterin raised the labor economics point that I keep coming back to. Unlike every previous automation wave, which displaced roughly 90% of jobs over 200 years while creating new ones, AGI might drive human labor value to zero as a default outcome, not as a panic scenario, as the base case if you don't design around it.
That's not a fringe view anymore.
It's not. His proposed mitigation is human augmentation and crypto-based property rights that give humans co-ownership of AI outputs, which sounds abstract, but it connects directly to the Circle episode on No Priors.
Tell me.
So Jeremy Allaire, Circle CEO, was on No Priors making the case that stablecoins and blockchain infrastructure are the essential financial rails for the agentic economy. And it's not the usual crypto pitch. The argument is specifically about what AI agents need that legacy banking can't provide.
Like what?
Agents need to dynamically spin up financial endpoints, transact at microscale. We're talking cents or fractions of a cent, settle globally in real time, 24/7. None of that works with ACH or wire transfers. And Circle's Newark blockchain is targeting costs of 1/1,000,000th of a penny per transaction. It's a different category of infrastructure. And what makes this more than just promotional? The Genius Act that passed in 2025 codified full reserve stablecoin architecture into federal law. That's real regulatory legitimacy. Allaire's been pitching this since 2013, and the legal framework finally caught up.
He's been in the desert for a long time.
He actually used that metaphor, broadband arriving after 10 years in the desert. Most prior crypto infrastructure was premature, not flawed. That's a more optimistic read than most finance people have.
And then the Big Technology podcast had Aaron Levy on, Box CEO, talking about the enterprise AI picture. What was his take?
His core argument was that AI agents are real, the timeline is just longer than Silicon Valley expects. The bottleneck isn't model capability, it's data. Most large enterprises have their information scattered across 20 to 100 systems with no single source of truth. Until that infrastructure is modernized, agents are unreliable.
So Box is the play.
He didn't say that explicitly, but yeah, the implication is that content and data management infrastructure becomes critical to AI adoption. And he had this great analogy. AWS was $500 million in revenue in 2010. Total cloud spend last year was a couple hundred billion. AWS, Azure, GCP all built $50 to $100 billion businesses from that same starting point. He thinks OpenAI and Anthropic are in that kind of market.
Not a zero-sum fight.
Right.
Although they're both clearly converging on the same roadmap, enterprise, coding, general agents, so the competition is going to be real.
Was there anything from the investing angle this week? Because I know you mentioned the odds on OpenPod. Yeah, this one was interesting for a different reason. Ex-Citadel, DSHAW PM Brett Cogburn was on, and his argument was that AI will actually make junior analyst careers better, not worse.
I'm skeptical.
So his framing is that AI is useful for what he calls the hunch and hypothesis phase, the first 5 to 15 hours of idea exploration. You can screen 60 ideas rapidly and knock out 50. But you cannot borrow conviction. His line was, the consensus view in public market investing is a losing view. An LLM trained on web scrapes is going to give you consensus. That's by definition not alpha.
So AI does the grunt work, humans do the judgment.
Right. And here's the contrarian take I actually found interesting. He thinks markets are more inefficient now, not less. The rise of quants, pod shops, and indexers has reduced fundamental price discovery. There are more expectation gaps for skilled fundamental investors to exploit, not fewer. Multi-manager platforms going from 10 to 60 billion AUM while sustaining double-digit returns is the empirical evidence.
That's counterintuitive given how much smart money is in the market now.
He'd say the smart money isn't doing fundamental work anymore. Okay, geopolitics, you've been waiting to talk about this.
I have.
So Peter Zeihan put out a video this week and the framing is stark. He's calling this the fastest collapse of American strategic power he's seen in his lifetime. The trigger is Trump's Truth Social post effectively declaring NATO finished and telling oil importing nations to secure Persian Gulf crude themselves.
Which is an enormous shift if you think about the architecture that's been in place since 1945.
The way Zeihan explains it, the 75-year American alliance system worked because it removed military competition from the equation. Once allies have to build independent navies to secure energy shipments, interstate conflict among oil importers becomes structurally inevitable. Japan, South Korea, India, European powers, they're all now in a game that was supposed to be over.
He's been predicting this would happen eventually. He just didn't think it would happen this fast.
That's exactly it. He draws the parallel to the Soviet collapse in 1991, but notes the U.S. retreat is far more globally extensive. Soviet losses were mostly Central Europe. U.S. losses spanned Europe, Middle East, and East Asia simultaneously.
The Economist podcast had good color on the NATO piece specifically. What's the current state of play in Brussels?
So the read from Anton LaGuardia on the NATO's Dialogues episode is that Rutte's charm offensive failed. No joint press conference, no public reconciliation after Trump's post. And the more alarming development is Rubio. Rubio was the one European-friendly voice in the administration. He literally sponsored the law requiring a Senate supermajority to formally withdraw from NATO. He's now calling it a one-way street.
When you lose Rubio on NATO.
That's the tell. And the legal barrier to withdrawal is largely symbolic anyway. Trump has three concrete levers without formally pulling out. Deny funds, pull troops, remove the American NATO commander.
The geopolitical cousins guys had an interesting take on the Iran piece specifically, the Strait of Hormuz angle.
Yeah, the Taco Tuesday episode was really good on this. Their argument is that the ceasefire is almost irrelevant to whether the strait stays open. Iran has set up a de facto toll booth, reportedly a $2 million fee per ship paid to an IRGC-linked entity, and ship traffic was already recovering before the ceasefire. The two dynamics are being conflated by markets and media.
And their oil take?
They framed it as asymmetrically bad to short oil. Their estimate is 65% probability Brent is at 70 in a month, but 35% probability it hits 200. That risk-reward is terrible for shorts even if your base case is right.
The 65-35 is the important number there. You're right more often than not and still lose money.
And there was a Taiwan data point in that episode that didn't get much attention. KMT chairwoman Chong Li-Woon visited China, and the hosts read it as a politician responding to focus group data showing fatigue with DPP assertiveness, accelerated by U.S. credibility damage from the Iran operation.
Taiwan watching the Iran situation and updating their priors about American reliability in real time.
That's the read. And it tracks with everything Zeihan is saying about the downstream effects of the strategic retreat. Every ally is doing that calculation simultaneously.
Okay, what are we watching today?
For me, it's the Strait of Hormuz traffic data. Not the rhetoric, not the ceasefire language, actual vessel movements, and whether that tolling mechanism holds or escalates. That's the real signal.
I'm watching the jobs revisions and any Fed commentary that comes out this week. Because if Paulson's right and the two-month average is really running at 40,000, that's a very different policy environment than the headline suggests. And I want to see if the broad market rotation he's calling actually shows up in this week's flows data.
I'm also keeping an eye on the No Kings protest organizing. The Professor G Pod had Harvard researcher Erica Chenoweth on this week, and she made the point that single protest days have historically correlated with midterm electoral outcomes. The 2017 Women's March correlated with 2018 candidate diversity and the Democratic House flip. If the pattern holds, the November 2026 cycle could look very different from today's picture.
There's a lot riding on that number. All right, that's Morning Signal for Thursday, April 9th. Thanks for being with us.
Stay sharp out there.
We'll see you tomorrow.